sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The ECB has gone wild. Waiting on Apple. What to make of the employment report? And we have guest Chris Hogan of the Dave Ramsey Group with us today. All this and so much more on episode number 380 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, good day, good afternoon, good evening. Andrew Horowitz here, and thanks for joining me on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. It's September 7th. And we have seen another record by the S&P 500. It looked like the S&P 500 was actually going to finish lower for the week. But miracle of miracles, on Friday there was, although a little bit lighter volume than the previous day, still higher volume than we saw most of the summer. As I had mentioned last week, we were going to start seeing traders come back to their desks and keyboards and their monitors and doing a little bit more buying and selling than we saw throughout the summer because volume was very light. And we did see that at the end of the day, there was a couple of things. Well, we had the employment report on Friday. A little bit confusing because we saw 140,000 new adds onto the payrolls. Expectations were closer to 200,000, yet the unemployment rate was at 6.1%. And as soon as that happened, it was very interesting because this is something that we see quite often. There was a lot of argument, a lot of discussion, and a lot of economists that were coming out to defend things, saying, you know, that's crazy. It's an aberration. It doesn't make any sense. Look at all the other numbers that we're seeing throughout the manufacturing and the GDP prints in terms of the employment, as well as what we've seen in initial claims on a regular basis throughout the last couple of months. And how in the world did we get to 140? It's not right. It's going to be changed. It's going to be revised. And you know what? It may be. But the fact is that we can't ignore the data that came out. Simply put, it was a very disappointing number overall. As a matter of fact, one of the reasons the market did, in fact, see a bit more life towards the end of the day after a lot of confusion was going on was that the Fed's chairman, Mr. Rosengren, came out and said that, oh, what a disappointment, and the Fed is going to be on hold because there's still a lot of slack in the economic markets, particularly when it comes to employment. And we know what happens when we see that there is a hint of stimulus that is going to be added or not withdrawn. Well, markets celebrate. And that's what happened. There really was a lot of confusion. Like I said, right when the number came out, there was a question as to what was going on. Is the economy slowing? But you know, if you look at much of the other numbers and you think about all the things that are going on, the market has been, or the economy has been, on a nice move, healing from a very, very sluggish first quarter. And maybe that was weather or otherwise. Second quarter also was a little sluggish in the beginning, but it started to heal. And then we saw that manufacturing started heating up, that the housing got better. We saw that the ISM non-manufacturing, the service sector, was getting better. Earnings in companies were improving, but outlooks still were very cautious. But yet, that may be a lot of sandbagging going on, where companies will say, oh, we think that things aren't as good, and we're expecting to earn, let's say, 50 cents a share. And what will happen is they can manage those expectations and then beat it by a couple of cents when their next earnings come out. But the other thing of interest, and really what was, I think, moving markets throughout the week probably in a major way, was the ECB. Mario Draghi came out and had a new and improved situation. He said, you know, there's a lot of deflation that's going on, and we are concerned that Europe is slowing down, and we're going to not allow that to happen. So instead of having a negative deposit rate of 0.1%, whereas when banks leave money on deposit at the Central Bank of Europe, the ECB, like our Fed. Our Fed is at a 0 to 0.25%. And what that means is that if a bank leaves money on deposit in overnight funds or just to keep money in the safest place they could find it, well, they'll not earn any money essentially, or maybe make a little bit, maybe 0.25%. That's the going rate. Well, the ECB said, you know, last month or so, we pushed this down to 0.1%. And the idea was that anybody that was going to put money on deposit with the ECB would have to pay. And we talked about this with Das, as a matter of fact, and talked about how this is going to work or not work some time ago. And if you recall, we both said that, you know, we're going to have to wait a little while. We're going to have to wait until we see how this all plays out and the actual effect of what banks do and how much money will be held on account at the ECB, et cetera. Well, now the ECB, it seems that that didn't do the trick, so they pushed it to 0.2%. So they doubled it. They doubled the cost of how much it would be if a bank was to leave money on deposit. And what that means really is that a bank is going to have to do a real good amount of thinking before they do that. In other words, they're going to really move the money out of the ECB, where they're going to have to pay a penalty, essentially, to have their money safely held into other places. Now, if you recall, one of the things that I mentioned was that while the last time when they initiated this plan, one of the things that they didn't do was any kind of quantitative easing. The ECB left the door open for asset purchases. And what they talked about was asset-backed securities, things like mortgages or maybe car loans or maybe consumer credit, asset-backed. In other words, collateralized money that was out there on loan. And if you think about a house, it means the asset is backing the loan. So I speculated at the time that what would happen is that the ECB is going to push money out of their holding and basically say to banks, hey, go out there and lend the money. And if, in fact, that doesn't work out so well and maybe loans go bad, we are probably going to come in with an asset-backed security purchase plan to rescue you. Now, it's too soon to tell whether or not a lot of money has hit the street and if, in fact, those loans are going to go bad. It's too short of a time period. You need some good time for things to kind of cycle around and for the loans to possibly either play out or, you know, go bad. So what happens is that right now the ECB said, we're going to double the cost now and we really want you to get your money out of our holding and lend it out. And if it wasn't good enough before by saying that we were thinking about an asset-backed purchase program, we're going to do a program that's about $800 billion worth of asset-backed purchases over the future, over the next year or so. Now, they also lowered their rate for the key interest rate that they have. And they made it to 0.05% from 0.1%. So essentially what the ECB did was throw the kitchen sink at the markets. They basically said, we are going to do some kind of a quasi-quantitative easing program, but we're going to use asset-backed securities because we know the ECB can't be purchasing and creating money due to the fact that it is a multi-country situation and much different than how we're set up here. But they're going to do as close as they can to mimic the quantitative easing program that we did and that Japan did through asset-backed securities. And they're going to push money out of the ECB. Well, what happened? Immediately, the euro took a nosedive. 1.5% it moved down against the dollar on that announcement. That's a very significant move in a very short period of time. And it moved down. It cracked the 130 level, headed down towards 129, currently about 129.5, let's call it. And that is supposedly very good for Europe because their exporters now are seen as having very good currency exchange rates so that if someone purchases something from Europe, let's call it Germany, well, they're going to get a discount. If the euro was 137 only a few months ago and now it's under 130, well, that 7 cents is a pretty good deal. It's maybe about a 5% benefit to buyers, making European goods that much more competitive. So that's the whole plan of what the ECB is trying to do. It's interesting because at the same time that really popped the dollar. Now, what's interesting about that is when you see the yen move down, what happens? The Nikkei does pretty well. Now, when the euro moves down, well, we saw those markets do very well as well as soon as the announcement was made. Yet, it doesn't appear that any of our multinationals that are based in the U.S., as an example, Caterpillar, is seeing any kind of major selling that's going on for their shares. Again, you would see that the opposite would also happen if in Japan the yen went higher, gained strength, that many of the companies that are major exporters lose money immediately. But again, there are a lot of buyers that are really thinking that the U.S. is the place to be. It's possibly a safe haven. It's a place that the Fed is not going to do anything much to upset the apple cart in terms of how the markets are accepting of low interest rates. And at the same time, we did see that the Fed is still coming out with commentary that they're going to possibly continue with a elongated interest rate policy that is very, very low. And there really is no need to have a increase in interest rates in any quick manner. So keep watching on what happens with the euro. And we did see that gold came down last week as the dollar rose. Oil came down as well, popped up on Thursday and Friday a bit. But still, what's really interesting is that we're finally seeing some sense of normality in terms of how different things like commodities react to the dollar. Because for a long time, there really wasn't any real correlation to the dollar and anything or any other currency. It was just a free-for-all. So it's good, I think, actually, that we're seeing that correlations are coming back to an extent. Now, when it comes to the S&P 500, I mentioned last week that we are seeing the key reversal indicator was peaking out a bit, and we did notice that right after that, there was a very slight sell-off. And then buyers came right back in, pounced on the markets because any sell-off is reason enough to buy. The dip can be 0.5%, 0.25%, 1%, whatever it is. And, you know, lo and behold, buyers come in because money is cheap. That's the bottom line. I also mentioned that Pollo Loco had their earnings last week, and I thought they were, at best, okay. They basically scraped by what the expectations were, and that's really not what you want to see in a hot, momentum-based IPO that just came to market. But yet the stock did finish higher after the earnings, but that was only after it dipped into the negative territory with a lot of confusion. And we'll see this week if there's going to be any downgrades or upgrades of the stock and how that's going to react to it. Because right now this is it acts very thin. In other words, the price of the shares intraday, very, very jumpy. And we also noticed that the momentum is still there when it comes to this because no one wants to not be in the next Chipotle. At least that's what the commentary is. I still think that this is a pretty good short right now and that the stock is significantly overvalued. And we will continue to hold our short position on that in the TDI or the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth portfolios. We've got to talk about Apple. We're going to talk about some of the things that are going to be happening and occurring this week coming up. But before we do that, we're going to get to our guest. And our special guest today is Chris Hogan. Now, Chris Hogan is with the Dave Ramsey team. He's actually one of the key speakers that travels around the country and speaks on all sorts of important topics ranging from business and leadership motivation. He's been a banker. He's been in business. He knows a lot of things about what makes business tick and how people are affected by money. Chris, did I get that right?
Yes, sir, you did.
Okay. Such a nice, beautiful, deep voice. Very commanding. So let me ask you a few things. I want to talk about a lot of different things related to business and mindset and items related to how people are viewing things these days, and particularly from what you're seeing traveling around. One of the things that struck me in some of the areas that you talk about regularly is the whole idea of life balance. And I'm kind of curious because, at least from my standpoint, I'm not quite sure what life balance is. You follow what I'm saying? I mean, what is the balance? Is it, you know, 50-50 of work and play? Is it, you know, 30 family, 30 business, work, you know, 10% spiritual? I mean, you know, I know there's probably no set number, but can you give me a little bit of a background of what kind of you talk about and what things are really important to people in terms of getting their life into balance and how it is maybe out of balance?
Yeah. Well, I can tell you this. This area of balance, it really doesn't exist. What you have to do is become very intentional about where you're spending your energy, your effort, and your focus. And I say that because you have to have awareness. I love the book Boundaries by Dr. Henry Cloud because he talks about putting some stakes in the ground in some areas where you're going to make sure I have these guidelines and these guiding factors. Because if you're trying to do anything in business where you're trying to make an impact and you're trying to make a difference, you're going to have some seasons where you're having to give 120 and 150%. The key is, though, is as you're doing that, is not to stay there. Like, we so often try to go 150 miles an hour in one direction, and we try to keep going in that route, and you redline, and eventually what happens is something's going to fail. So I kind of encourage people to have awareness, and if you are going to hit a season where you're going to be busier than normal, you want to make sure you get your home team on board. That's your wife, your husband, to make sure everybody understands, hey, here's what's coming up. Here's what it's going to take for me. Here's what I need for you to support me during this time. And if you'll do that, what happens is you're going to be able to focus more, and the home team's going to feel like they understand exactly what's going on. And that creates a healthy environment for anybody trying to be successful.
Yeah, and your example, you know, you're talking about redlining and all. I mean, at the end of the day, when you redline a car and you continue to do it and push a little bit too far, what happens? You blow a piston.
That's exactly right. You know? And that's exactly what people have happen in their lives. You know, where they're trying to go too much. And so, you know, being aware of that, where you can understand that, hey, I'm here in my red line area and I know I'm going to have to go this long, but I need to be smart about pulling up to make sure I come up for air, that I'm understanding exactly what I have left to do, and I'm focused so I can be as effective as I can be.
So bring some of the economic factors into this. One of the things that we do know is that from the official gauges, we know that there's no inflation, but the reality is that everything's costing more. And whether you are, you know, a person in business or working for someone, the fact of the matter is that there's this constant need to maybe make more money. Maybe I'm not talking about excessively. I'm talking about your normal operation of life, right? You know, you need to make more money to keep pace with the payments, you know, whether you're going to have kids that grow up and then pay for college, or you're going to have a new car that you buy eventually, or whatever it is that's going to happen, okay? So now this life balance situation where maybe you're at 150% for a period of time, and hopefully that will then become a way that you've made more money for yourself to live a little more comfortably, then to put life back in balance and maybe put the 150% into family, for example, right? For the next session. But sometimes it doesn't work out. Sometimes you fail, right?
And I would tell you this, it can happen. But here's the thing. Like, for example, you know, Andrew, if I'm at work during work hours, guess what? I'm focused on work. But here's the deal. When I get done on my drive home, I kind of turn on things and I'm kind of letting work go. Because I know when I get home and that garage door is going up, I got three young boys waiting on daddy and I've got a wife waiting on her husband. So I encourage people to be exactly where you are. Stay focused on that, and that way you'll maximize your time. Now, on the financial side, you're absolutely right. People are pressed. They have their backs against the wall. There's a statistic out in USA Today that talks about 70% of people are living paycheck to paycheck. Mm-hmm. And so how can they help themselves? Well, I'll tell you this. Dave Ramsey's Baby Steps, plugging into that plan where you start to have a plan for your money and you start telling it where to go instead of wondering where it went, that's how people can give themselves a raise. It's called awareness. And so you start budgeting, you start dealing with debt and getting it out of your life, and the next thing you know, more of your money gets to stay with you instead of going to creditors.
Right. It's the whole idea of being in control of that versus that being in control of you.
Yes, sir, and I love how you put it, because at the end of the day, you're not going to be able to effectively manage anything you're not aware of and that you're not in control of.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. You know, it's interesting. You also talk to businesses and real estate and all this stuff with relation to the idea of leadership. and the idea of networking. I was wondering if you've done any research or you've had any discussions on the change or maybe the progression in how we're seeing like corporate America, how they are managing things, working with their employees, trying to build a company versus today, versus where there was, I don't know, 15 years ago, let's say, 20 years ago for that matter. Has there been, in your opinion, and from what you've seen, a change in that dynamic?
It really has. I think 15 years ago, everyone was focused on still trying to get results, trying to make things happen. I think as we become more social in society via social media and having all these things where brands and companies are starting to understand that it's imperative that they have relationship with people, and so they have to be connected. And so people do business with people that they like or that they admire or that they can understand. And so there's definitely been a shift, so to speak, in the marketing dollars spent on trying to make sure they're more social and more connected with their customers and prospective customers out there. So there is a different wave, and I think we're only going to see more of that here in the next near future.
But I do wonder something. I got to tell you something. I wonder if the marketing that went from, let's just call it marketing at you through television mm-hmm. and various mm-hmm. media, that was just, you know, all right, I think this is what they'll like and let's put it there, to, hey, let's find out what they like and then mold our advertising to that. Now, one caveat, assuming that they're not just molding it for the sake of molding it. You follow what I mean?
Yes.
And then providing some kind of a way to for you to wake up and look at something rather than tell you the factual information about it. Because I'm kind of somehow, and not this is not scientific, somehow getting the feeling that there is a good amount of, we'll say manipulation in a way, of advertising. And I'm not sure if that's good or bad.
Yeah. Well, I would tell you this. Companies know that they have to be more flexible now than ever. And I like what you said. Companies are getting smarter because they're starting to ask people what they want. And then here's the beautiful thing of it. When they ask, they begin to listen and change things based on the information that they're getting back. And I think companies years ago would send out surveys, but it was more so for the look of the survey, that we look like we're being attentive.
Right.
Now companies are reading it and starting to change it because they realize they don't feel that requirement to stay loyal as long. They're going to go where they want to go, and they're going to go where their needs are being met. So companies have to be more flexible and able to change a little bit quicker than they had 2 years ago.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned the word loyalty. That's a big issue because that comes from the other side, right? I mean,
that is correct.
Yeah. So here's something interesting. So I'm rebuilding a house, remodeling a house, and all that, and my loyalty has gone out the window. My loyalty is to the lowest bidder, if you will, of a product. So I just bought all the appliances online. I mean, very heavy, large appliances, oven and new refrigerator. I went and I found a place that had the same particular item that I wanted, and I got it at the lowest price, and I got it with no shipping charges. Now, I don't even know who that company was. And by the way, if I had to buy the exact same thing today, the exact same thing, I bought it 3 weeks ago, I don't necessarily know that I would buy it from the same place.
Yes.
And that's a bit of a problem, because while social media and the internet and the connectiveness is helping to provide better information to the company so that they can then provide for what the customer wants, the fact is, at the end of the day, if there is this incredible transparency and visibility and ease of access, how do they continue to maintain loyalty?
Well, I think it's one of those where from their existing clientele, you know, they have to understand people in this day and age, they're going with the best deal. And I think there are a lot of things where people, especially like, for example, appliances, where they have certain brands that they say, you know what, my parents used it, it was reliable, great. But then you have other people that say, you know what, I'm only looking for the best deal. Or other people are looking for the ease of convenience, mm-hmm. where, you know, they can get it done and get it done quick. And I think that's the challenge for businesses these days, you know, that they're going to be able to understand what is their niche. What do they fit in? What's their value proposition? Are they a company that can get things done quickly? Or do they have is reliability the thing that they focus on? Or are they flexible, you know, by offering people a variety of options? And I think the more companies can understand their own niche, then that's where they're going to really be able to hone in and find customers or prospective customers that are looking for that.
So how do we then, as customers, I'm taking the other side for a minute here, how do we as customers have the ability to feel good and rely on, for example, another crazy situation I'm involved in, a little thing that makes me scratch my head. I went on Amazon because I was looking for a wireless doorbell, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I found a wireless doorbell. It had 1,100 reviews. And I'm thinking
wow.
to myself, who is reviewing a doorbell?
Yes.
But 1,100, that is a lot of reviews. And I figured, I got to buy this one.
That's right.
I got to buy it. I have to. Now, then after I bought it, I said, you know, how easy would it to be for the company to spend $40 per and then post their own quality review? I mean, I'm just saying, it's possible.
You know what? It is possible. And I would tell you, I think as you begin to read those and see those, I am skeptical at times as I read the reviews. But when I see a larger number or something where, you know, where there's a blend of people, you know, 4 stars that love it, but then there are some down that don't like it. You know, when I see kind of a cross-section of a review, that's when I start to think, okay, you know what, it's real. You know, it's mm-hmm. a little bit more legitimate.
Right.
And guess what? I think in this day and age, we all start with our own circle of influence, and we all ask friends or people we trust to try to get a recommendation. But after that, we're going online to kind of do our comparative analysis ourselves. That way we don't have to make the trip to the you know, the local hardware store to try to check on a wireless doorbell. We've got it at our fingertips. And I think in this day and age, having so much information at our fingertips, it really empowers us as consumers.
Oh yeah, no, I think it really is in a way a buyer's market in terms of a lot of consumer products. And that's what's happening to many companies. That's why the Office Depot, the Staples, for example, I mean, you can get this stuff at no cost, and it's a fascinating and easy process. And for example, even, I mean, something like shoes. I mean, yeah, a little bit difficult, the sizing issue, but all right, you get a few pairs and send it back. But you know what? What's really fascinating about the way that this is going right now is that, and this is a little off topic, is that if I go into a store, they may or may not have my size. They may or may not have the color I want, right? Because they can only stock so much of whatever it is.
Right.
Whereas I go online, and if I don't find it one place, I may be able to find it somewhere else and have it delivered in 2 days. But, and that's changing the whole relationship of consumers and sellers in general, right?
It definitely is. And it's removing the human aspect from it.
Yes.
Because you and I know if you go into a department store or to any store, you're going to connect with a sales associate. And so this person's job is to kind of size you up, you know, your personality, your preference, and they're there to kind of be your concierge throughout the process. And so, yes, some of that element is being lost by our online, but I think that's where companies are really looking at what is the digital experience that we're giving to clients. You know, so a place like Amazon, for example, they're really focused on what's the e-commerce model. Is it easy for people to check out? You know, is there a way to click and compare certain products side by side? And so I think that's where companies are really trying to make sure that they're still staying connected with people and giving them options.
Now, but what does that say about all that we just discussed? And this dives right into a lot of the things that you are involved in terms of customer service training, discussion of employee engagement, in terms of team building. What does that say about the future? Again, if we continue to slope in this direction, okay? What does that say about the future, about personal relationships and the ability for people to connect and, you know, be social and have a way of, you know, having not only friendships, but relationships, not only, I mean, it's all kind of, there's an addition to this now. It's no longer the creation of just, okay, size this person up because I just met them, because essentially, before I meet you, I can do tons of research very easily on you.
That's exactly right. I think what it's going to do as we get more and more digital and online, I think the individuals, the people out there that have people skills, the ability to be able to communicate, the ability to be able to connect those people are only going to stand out more and more, because I think more of those skills will continue to diminish with as much online as we continue to have.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would encourage people to make sure, yeah, it's okay to go online to do some shopping, but we still need to make sure that we're building and sustaining healthy relationships, whether it's in our church and our workplace and with our families. You know, let's not rely totally on digital, because, you know, digital online, it won't give someone a hug when they need it. You know, it won't give someone that word of encouragement, that supporting hug when someone's having a hard time or having a great time. So I would say, just as individuals, we got to make sure we don't skew one way or the other, but we stay kind of in the middle of, and having the ability to be effective online in our writing and our way of interacting, but also in face-to-face interactions, with the ability to be able to hold a conversation.
Yeah. Now, what are your thoughts on the whole, idea of being able to absorb and then take a look at, decipher all of the information that comes in on, let's say that you are an investor, let's say that you're in the real estate business, let's say whatever it may be, right? The daily deluge of information, the information overload from sources just everywhere. How do you teach people to differentiate, compartmentalize, ignore, so that they can have a very focused day throughout the day?
Yeah, I would say, you're absolutely right. Without there, with there being so many options out there for information, what I encourage people to do is to come up with their framework. You know, like, how are they gauging that something is reliable, authentic, and trustworthy? As they begin to come up with those own personal parameters, I encourage them to get out there and see what's there. But also, above all, I want them to reach out and connect with a professional, someone that they trust, that does it. You know, it's not someone that they dabble in, but somebody that is in the investing world, and they are a professional. And find out from them some resources that they trust that will help them become a little bit more educated in those areas.
Yeah.
And so when you do that, you start to cull down and develop kind of your own personalized stream of information from sources you trust and that you deem credible.
Mm. So I know you're speaking all around the country. Where are the next few places that people could maybe, see you? Where are you next?
Absolutely. I'm actually heading out next week with Dave. Dave Ramsey. We're going to be in Grand Rapids, Michigan, talking about entree leadership. So we're going to help business leaders and owners start to understand how they can run their company more effectively.
Mm-hmm.
After that, then I'm coming back here in Nashville for a 3-day entree leadership conference where I'm dealing with leaders and managers and helping them grow. And then I'm off to Pittsburgh and then to Texas. So I'm staying busy here in the month of September, but I love what I do.
No, you're not going to Hawaii or Puerto Rico, or you don't get to go there? They don't send you there?
You know what, Andrew? I'm hiring you as my agent. I want you to get me to those places, and you and I will go have great conversations.
Absolutely. And we're going to the Waikiki Beach Resort to speak on these subjects. Absolutely.
I like the way you think.
Well, Chris Hogan, I appreciate you spending some time talking about some of the recent changes in the overall relationship area, as well as life balance, time management. I encourage people to go check it out. I'll get all the links, the things that you need to know, how to get there, on the show notes for this particular episode. Chris, you keep up the good work.
Hey, thank you. And listen, if your people want to stay connected with me, they can connect with me on Twitter at ChrisHogan360.
At ChrisHogan360. Okay, well, let me just say aloha.
Aloha. Thank you, my friend.
All right, bye-bye.
Take care. Bye now.
You know, it's interesting. One of the things we talked about and really focused in on that conversation with Chris was the whole idea of social media and how social media is changing things and how it is creating a much wiser consumer, also a retailer who's that much wiser. That much wiser into the things that we're looking for, and hopefully they are going to not use that just to sell, but also to provide a much-needed change in the relationship between the consumer and the seller. Because in the past, really, you were at the whim of what the selling was going on. And while fashion was created, for example, and we followed, maybe there's going to be a change to that. Maybe there's going to be a situation where we have retailers really coming out with a significant amount of options available for things that we want. That could really spread to many different places and many different types of businesses. It would be a good thing. I still worry about how there is the potential for misuse of that, but also I think that if used correctly, it can really benefit us all significantly. We'll see how that really plays out when it comes to the retailers, who, by the way, we've seen several retailers come out with some very sluggish same-store sales. Gap, Zumiez, and a few others came out with what I would call very unimpressive numbers. Don't forget, we had Macy's and the other big box retailers really not do so well this quarter when they came out with their earnings a number of weeks ago. Even though the stocks continue to move higher, even though they missed their earnings, even though their outlook was, I would say, very conservative and somewhat negative, and the stocks continue to move higher nonetheless, the idea is that, well, the bad times aren't going to last forever. The truth of the matter is, the way that investors are acting right now, you have to wonder why in the world anybody would ever sell anything. It seems that that's what they're thinking, at least. Because at this point, when you see a company come out with negative earnings and possibly a negative outlook, it takes only about a quarter or so for everybody to forget what's going on and to simply go and start buying the stock again. I find that really fascinating. I find it fascinating because it's a real look into the psychology of the markets. And really what you have to know there is that when we're dealing with psychology of the market, the overriding bullish or bearish sentiment can really make things look, you know, good dependent on how you really perceive the market moving forward. And I really, if you think about that, this is where the good news equals good market, bad news equals good market, or in the reverse, when you have a really negative sentiment. You have to look at the trend and try your best to follow it, but don't be sucked in to any of the shenanigans, particularly when it comes to the discussions of many of the personalities that you'll see on TV who are perma bulls, it looks like. So anyway, I want to talk about two things. I want to talk about Apple for a second, but I also want to talk about, in a moment, the whole idea of expense ratios. This is something that we touch on every once in a while, but I want to kind of have a discussion about that once again. But let's talk about Apple. Last week there was a leak, maybe? There was something that came out that talked about the iPhone 6, and Apple dropped out 4%, dropped under the and closed under $100 for the week per share. And it looks like on the 9th, when this big announcement of maybe the next generation of the iPhone comes out, that maybe the iPhone 6 is not all what people were hoping for. Now, also remember something. That last quarter, when Apple came out with their earnings, their outlook, which is usually the case, they usually guide a little low, their outlook was not impressive at all. Again, that was absolutely 100% totally ignored. Nobody really cared about it because even though it was concerning, oh, who cares? That's what Apple does. They sandbag and they have this iPhone 6 coming out. Maybe they have the watch coming out. Maybe they have an upgrade to the tablets coming out. And even though that some of the sales in some areas weren't that good, the Mac sales were good. So everybody said, okay, you know, we'll give them a break. We'll give them a free ride here and we'll hope for the best. And then all of a sudden, now as we're getting closer and closer to the September 9th debut of something, whether it's going to be the new iPhone 6, the new operating system, the iWatch or the iTime or whatever it's called, and maybe something else that they have up their sleeves, the big question is going to be, can Apple do it again? They've done it before many times. Big question is, can they do it again? I'm going to be watching it, and I'm going to be watching for a couple of things. Let me tell you what. First of all, the release of the next operating system. That is something they promised us, and I believe that will be happening on the 9th. The second thing is that the iPhone 6, the big question is going to be, I think, about what the capability will be with some kind of a payment system that's fully integrated. Now, what a lot of things that we know that we're going to see already is that we're going to have an update to the operating system. And a lot of things are embedded in there, and that's the way the phone works, and that's the whole benefit of having a smartphone, because you can have an operating system that changes even though you have an older phone. You don't have to have a hardware upgrade necessarily, but this next generation of iPhone, maybe with a near-field communication or something else that will be really fantastic in terms of a real wallet, because the wallet they have now is it's nothing. But some kind of an integration with payments, so you don't have to have credit cards anymore and cash, and it makes it easy. A new model beyond what is out there these days would be really cool to have. And on top of that, a faster processor, better camera. These are the things that we expect to have. Everybody always expects whenever there's a hardware upgrade by Apple, this is standard, that you have maybe a flash on the front and the back. Maybe you have better cameras. Maybe you have a better compression algorithm that can compress photos and possibly videos to hold more. So we're not really sure because a lot of things haven't been released, but so far what did happen is that the leak that occurred earlier in the week, last week, about what the iPhone 6 is and what they're going to be announcing or not announcing seemed to spook a lot of people into selling off Apple very significantly. So the 9th will be the day. Coming up this week, fast approaching. So I'm looking forward to that. By the way, on Tuesday, which is also the 9th, that's the day, at 11 o'clock in the morning, I'll be hosting a TradeStation stocks and ETF update over at TradeStation. If you just look up TradeStation stocks and ETF update, there's a place to register. We have that also on our site over at TradeStation. You can find it there. And we'll also tweet it out. If you don't follow us, well, now's the time. You can just do at Andrew Horowitz. It's one word. And follow us on Twitter. And what will happen is that we will give you tweets of important things that are occurring, the various webinars and seminars that we are going to be holding, and as well as you'll be one of the first to know when a podcast is out, anything that we write, things of that nature. So definitely make sure to follow us on Twitter so you can be the first to get all that information available to you instead of trying to search for it and figure it out where it's going to be. It will be just right there at your fingertips. Now let's talk a little bit about the whole idea of expense ratios. This is something that we did a little bit of analysis on the last couple of weeks. We had a client come in and we looked at their portfolio. And one of the things that I noticed was that there was significant underperformance of many of the mutual funds and ETFs that they owned. And what we do is we take a look at the ETF or the mutual fund when we look at these. And we look to see how they compare against their peers. Now, moreover, not just simply looking at, oh, what is this compared to the S&P 500? Or what is it compared to a small cap? But what is it compared to its exact reference of peers? And then we go one step further and look inside the portfolio to see if, in fact, the holdings of the portfolio match up to what the actual outlook and objective of the fund and the manager is. So for example, if there's the ABC Large Cap Growth Fund, and that's their name, and the objective that we see on various sources is large cap growth, as you would imagine, we then take a look at it against its peers, but then go one step further and say, okay, what's in the portfolio? Let's look at the holdings and then look at it to see if, in fact, the manager is holding what they said they're going to hold. Because one of the things you don't want to have when you set up a portfolio and you buy into a mutual fund or an ETF is something called style drift. And style drift is when you have a situation where, let's say that you have this ABC Large Cap Growth Fund, and you look inside the portfolio and there's 20% utility stocks, let's say, and 10% bonds, for whatever reason. And again, this may be a little bit of an extension and a far-fetched example, but just follow me here. So you have these things inside the portfolio that are not making any sense. They're not what you expected. They're definitely not the high quality or the large cap growth that you would expect to see at all. What does that mean? That means a style drift. And when you think that you're buying a particular fund or an ETF that is based on a specific style or a specific outlook, objective, whatever you want to call it, and all of a sudden you're getting something else, it's kind of like going to the store and buying lettuce and getting inside of your lettuce asparagus and cauliflower. Well, that's not what you wanted. It's still a vegetable, but it's not what you wanted. So what do? Well, you got to make sure not to have something like that. And then what we do further is then compare, okay, well, this particular fund has some small caps in it, even though they're supposed to be only large caps. It has some utilities in it. Okay, fine. How does it all compare that way? If we look at the fund itself, how does that manager compare to that benchmark that we create out of the actual holdings? Well, one of the things that we noticed on this particular portfolio was that many of the mutual funds were underperforming. And it was kind of interesting because all of them were underperforming. But not just underperforming on a one-year basis, two-year, but going back on a rolling basis all the way back 10 and 15 years. And we were wondering, what is the story here? What is going on? Well, we got dug a little further and we noticed that, wow, the expense ratios on these funds were very high. What does that do? When you have expense ratios on a fund that are more than they should be, or let's say much higher than they should be, that could possibly not only eat into the profitability of the fund, but you also have the problem that if you are a certain style and you're looking to, let's say, benchmark against the large cap growth, and that particular index, let's say, earns 5%, and you have a 1% fee inside of your mutual fund, well, you have to have not only 5%, but 6% to have a performance that is on par with your benchmark. And what we found was that these funds were really very, very poorly performing, and a lot of it had to do with not only expense ratios, but style drift. So what you thought you were getting, and this client thought they were getting from this other advisor, was a particular portfolio. And the advisor even said, oh, yeah, you have this much stock and this much bonds in your portfolio. But when we broke it down and looked at the actual holdings inside of the portfolio and segregated it amongst not only the sectors, but looking at it from an asset allocation standpoint, the assumptions that the advisor made were way off. I mean, way off. And I'm telling you this because I want you to look at your mutual funds and I want you to take a look and say, hey, wait a minute, what is it that I actually own here? Mutual funds are a great place to invest long-term, depending on what your style is. Clearly, we talk about stocks a lot here on this podcast. But one of the things you have to know also is that there are alternatives. For example, there are ETFs that you can invest in. Now, why would you invest in an ETF, for example, that is an S&P 500 ETF that has a 0.5% expense ratio when another one may have a 0.2? If the whole idea is to invest in a basket of securities that are the S&P 500 companies and that are at the same proportional amount of the S&P, so stock A in the S&P is 2%, well, stock A inside of your ETF should be 2%. Why in the world, if there are two ETFs that do the same thing, would you pay a higher price? I mean, there are some reasons sometimes, but generally speaking, that doesn't make any sense, right? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. Why would you pay double the fee for that particular ETF? It's one thing if you have active management. Now, this is a whole different discussion. So we're talking about mutual funds and ETFs, and we're talking about passive management, where you're just looking to really perform according to a benchmark. What we want to do is find a manager that doesn't have style drift, that keeps on par with a particular index or benchmark, and that has a low cost of doing so. Now, that's passive management. Active management, on the other hand, is when you have an advisor that may be going outside the boundaries of simply investing according to a benchmark, simply looking to mimic a particular index. And maybe they're investing in bonds of emerging markets. Now, I got to tell you something. I don't want an index for that. I want to make sure that I'm finding a manager that can essentially understand the various currency parameters of an economy in Central America or South America or anywhere they're investing in the emerging markets. I want to know if they understand about the government and the potential problems that's going on there, the deficits and the surplus of those countries, what's happening maybe from a standpoint of political unrest, maybe even possibly war or some other issues that may be affecting their economy. Maybe their economy is based on a particular commodity, and how is that going to affect the bonds of that particular country if, in fact, the commodities move one way or the other. There's a lot of things that they have to know, maybe even speak a different language. That's active management. They're going out there and they are looking to do something different than simply beat or equalize towards a benchmark. towards an index, and they're going out actively looking for investments that are appropriate. That I'm willing to pay money for. That you can have a range of what the cost is going to be. And then it comes down to how that has done on a risk-adjusted measure, and that's important. But at the same time, when it comes to those things that are commoditized, like ETFs, you want to put the least costly that you can find inside of your portfolio. So take a look at the expense ratios of your ETFs, of your mutual funds. See, in fact, what the objective, the written objective of the mutual fund is, if it is, in fact, to keep pace with the S&P 500, or if it's to mimic the small cap, the Russell Small Cap Index, or if it's European stocks that are, and that includes Asia, let's say, such as EAFE, E-A-F-E. You know, these are kind of things that you want to look at, because if without doing that, you're really doing yourself a terrible, and your portfolio for that matter, a terrible disservice. So style drift, making sure that there is none in portfolios that are supposed to be aligned with a particular index. Expense ratios in terms of keeping the costs down for passive investments, those that are, again, just simply trying to be on par with a particular index. And active investing, okay, that's fine. Style drift there as well. But we're willing to pay up a little bit for that in a mutual fund. And you usually don't get those in ETFs, usually. There are some that you do, but you don't want to pay up too much. But make sure the expense ratios are within a range of other active managers. It's all a comparison game, because that's really what the mutual fund and ETF game is all about. And we do a lot of that with our global allocations. We really spend a lot of time digging down and making sure that each of those are appropriate. And you have to do that yourself as well when it comes to your investments, when it comes to mutual funds and ETFs. So this week we have Apple coming up. We have more fallout from the ECB. We also have a Fed meeting that's going to be coming out. We have some economics, but not as urgent and important as what we saw last week with the ISM and the manufacturing numbers, the ADP, the employment report. All those things were very key to last week. Here we go into back into normal season. The volume should be picking up even further as more and more traders come back and get the feel of what's going on in the waters of the markets. And from there, we're going to kind of see if all this can hold up and if we continue to see the buy the dip mentality for much longer as the S&P 500 is really reaching some fully valued, if not overvalued, levels right now. And the dollar continues to pick up pace in terms of a higher level and possibly hurting the exporters. Also going to be watching bonds this week. I think you should watch this, the TLT, as an example, as a proxy. This is an ETF that is the proxy for the long-term bond, and see how that plays out. There was a lot of movement in that last week, particularly when we saw the ECB come out with their announcement. So keep a watch, put that on your watch list, because as the TLT goes up in value, yields come down. And the question is, how much lower can yields go? Or are we going to finally see that with the economy healing, the Fed coming to an end to their quantitative easing program, and the dollar rising, if in fact there's going to be a change in that dynamic? Anyway, thanks for joining me. If you want to find out more information about Chris Hogan and all the information that we talked about today, it's on thedisciplinedinvestor.com on the show notes page of this particular episode. Of course, join me for our Tuesday-Wednesday podcast, Tuesday/Wednesday, with John C. Dvorak. That's always fun to listen to. And again, TradeStation Tuesdays. Stocks and ETF update, I'll be there, and I hope you join me. We'll be talking about all sorts of things related to stocks and ETFs, some interesting indicators. I go through a discussion of a particular indicator, a particular level. Also take your stock questions right there. It's a free webinar available to you, and we host it with the help of TradeStation. Thanks so much for joining me. It's Andrew Horowitz. We'll see you again next week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company. a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.